Well, looking forward to seeing a musical memoir of the 60s and beyond, the Regent Theater, Arlington, Mass., just outside of Boston, May 18th at 2 o'clock. Does the story begin for you at the Westminster School when you met Gordon Waller, or does it go back even further?
Well, it depends. My affection for music goes back quite a lot further because, you know, I grew up in a very musical household. My mother was a classical musician. My father was an amateur pianist as well as being a doctor. So music was always part of it. My father loved choral music particularly and used to make us do, turn us into a quartet. You know, he'd have my sister singing soprano and I'd be singing tenor and he'd sing bass and so on. So music's always been part of the agenda and part of the process. But then, yes, the possibility of making music ourselves on the popular scale was at Westminster School when I met Gordon. I'd noticed that there was another pupil wandering around carrying a guitar case. So we naturally gravitated towards each other and introduced ourselves. And he knew a few more chords than I did. So we, you know, went back in that stage. If someone knew a new cool chord, they'd show their friends, and that's how, you know, we'd all learn gradually a little bit of music theory and some chords. And so Gordon and I, you know, if we'd met two other people who played, we might easily become a band like everybody else did, but we were stuck at the duo stage, so we just glommed onto the Everly Brothers as our heroes, and that was that. We tried to sound as much like them as we could and didn't succeed. But the point is, you try to imitate somebody, and in failing to get it exactly right, you come up with something that might actually be your own, and your own style and harmonies, and that's kind of what we tried to do.
We've talked about this with you before, but for anybody who doesn't know the story, I love the fact that there was a musical connection before you between your mother and George Martin.
There was indeed, and the books get it slightly wrong, because they often say, oh, my mother was teaching at the Guildhall School of Music where George was, but it actually wasn't that way. My mother taught at the Royal Academy of Music. George went to the Guildhall School of Music, which is a separate school. But his second instrument was the oboe. His first instrument was piano and composition. But he realized that he had an exam coming up and his oboe playing might not be up to snuff. So he asked somebody for recommendations of a musician who gave private oboe lessons that could have whipped him back into shape, ready for his exams. And they recommended my mother. So he took private lessons. He actually came to our flat in London when we, you know, my sisters and I were really little, and my mom would teach him the oboe. So the strange thing is that by the time she met him again later on as her daughter's boyfriend's record producer, it was like, oh, yes, I know George. Hi. And that was that.
Do you remain grateful that John Lennon just couldn't stand the lyric, "Please lock me away"?
I do, yes. As you obviously know the story. But yeah, he thought it was a ridiculous lyric. And he would just say, oh, okay, I will lock you away. The song's over. You know, so it was clear that they weren't going to record it. This was not going to be a Beatles record. I don't think he quite thought he was up to standard anyway. And I certainly did. So when we had a record deal in place and we were looking for songs, I said to Paul, you know, what's the story with that song? Are you giving up on it? Are you giving it to someone? Are you going to finish it? Because it wasn't even finished. It didn't have a bridge. And he said, oh, I don't know. Well, you know, you can have it casually. And of course, that changed my life forever. Indirectly.
You got caught up in the crush that became known as the British invasion. Was it easier for you to adjust to that because you had worked as a youngster, as an actor, and you'd had celebrity thrust into your life before?
I suppose, yes. I mean, I wasn't famous, but yes, I'd seen the sort of press machine at work and stuff like that. And yes, I mean, I was aware of all that stuff, but it was kind of different. So suddenly to be part of the British invasion and, you know, to us, of course, coming to America was an unthinkable dream. And we were so excited when our record went to number one. And the biggest thing to us and to the Beatles when it happened to them a few months previously, when I went to Old Japan, went to number one. But it clearly meant to all of us that, yes, you were going to America. Yes, we would actually get to the land of our dreams. And to get to New York, you know, and see the New York skyline. I had posters on my wall of the New York skyline. I had copies of Downbeat with the jazz clubs I wanted to go to once I made it to America circled. And I knew I'd get to go eventually somehow. I didn't know how. And so it was extraordinarily exciting. And then, of course, to get to New York and actually be chased around that famous landscape by screaming teenage girls trying to tear your clothes off. Life doesn't get much better than that.
Well, even was it at the New York World's Fair where the girls were trying to swim across essentially a moat between them and the stage?
Exactly. There was a moat. And the police said, oh, you'll be okay. You know, there's got policemen on the side of the stage and they can't get in and they'd have to cross the moat and everything. And the first thing the girls all did was jump in the moat and swim across. So it was like an early version of a wet T-shirt contest. We relished every second of it.
Well, what was it about the studio process, the production of records, that drew your interest as a young man?
Once I realized that this job existed, you know, that you could hire great musicians much better than yourself and tell them what to do and try out ideas and experiment, I thought that was brilliant. So I immediately thought, that's a job I'd like to have. I think I could do that because I did have ideas and musical ideas. So the minute I got the opportunity, I did it.
Was it out on a Dick Clark tour that you first heard Del Shannon do I Go to Pieces?
No, it was a tour of Australia, actually.
Ah, okay.
There was the promoter, Dick Clark did American tours. I don't think he ever did anything overseas. A guy called Harry Miller was the promoter. Later on went to prison, I think, for some kind of ticket fraud or something dramatic. But it was on that tour that we met Del Shannon for the first time, liked him very much. And he turned out he had this song. And actually, he thought it would be a good idea for the Searchers to do it. They were on the bill with us. And his first try was to persuade the Searchers they should record I Go to Pieces. But they didn't think it was right for them, strangely, I think, because they probably could have made a really good record out of it. But they politely declined. And I'd overheard this exchange. Said, look, if no one's doing it, you know, could we do it? And could we have a go at it? And he said, yes, of course. And we worked it out there on the road at rehearsals and sound checks and so on, and decided we loved it. And I said to Dale, please don't give it to anybody else. As soon as we get back from Sydney, we shall record it, which we did.
The irony is your songs were doing very well in America, but not as well back home in the UK until you recorded Buddy Holly's True Love Ways.
That's right, I think. Yeah, I lose track of lose track of which ones were hits in America and which ones were hits in England. But yes, there were some cases. And then, you know, we covered an American hit with Baby, I'm Yours. And the strange thing was, you know, that of course, we couldn't release in America because it had been a big hit for Barbara Lewis. But we thought we could make a duet version that would be a hit. And we did succeed. And that became a hit in England and not in America. So it was quite involved. And I think Lady Godiva was a bigger hit in America, I think. And I don't know. I Go to Pieces, I don't think was a hit in England at all.
Was Don't Pity Me
sure.
the first...
I don't know this chart in my head.
Was it Don't what? Pity Me that was the first American hit that you and Gordon wrote?
Yes, Gordon mostly wrote that. We shared it officially, but that was primarily Gordon's song. And yeah, it was a cool record. This was the big dramatic version of Gordon, which we'd used before on True Love Ways, of course, too. You know, his opening to that tune is one of the things that make it a hit, I think. The whole just you know, the way Gordon could, only Gordon could do it. And it made a difference. But yes, Don't Pity Me was the first song that was a hit, any kind of a hit that we wrote or Gordon wrote.
You did all the American television shows, Ed Sullivan, Dick Clark, Shindig, Hullabaloo. Yep. Was it the shows where you could actually play and sing live that you enjoyed the most?
Yes, undoubtedly. You know, it's fun doing those other TV shows and meeting people and stuff, but of course the actual performance isn't the performance at all. It's just you pretending to sing to a track. So that gets a little tiring after a while because every performance is identical by definition. And I much prefer real live. Ed Sullivan was live, of course, with the Ed Sullivan Orchestra, who played great. And Shindig had great musicians as well. So those are the ones that were fun. And those make you nervous and excited and everything, because you've got to actually not make mistakes and get it right and sing in tune and all that stuff. Whereas, of course, when you're lip-syncing, it doesn't matter what the hell you sing.
You guys were ahead of your time recording an album in Nashville with producer Ken Nelson. What was that whole experience like for you?
Well, it was interesting because, you know, we Gordon in particular loved country music, and we decided to make an album of the country songs we loved. It was catchily titled Peter and Gordon Sing and Play the Hits of Nashville, Tennessee. Quite a long title. And we just did great country tunes that we loved, you know, Send Me the Pillow That You Dream On and so on, all the classics. And it was fun. And what we discovered later is that Ken Nelson, the producer, who was great, and the musicians, who were top-notch, were kind of nervous because they were kind of going, no, we don't know how to play this British Invasion stuff, and we're not sure how to make that kind of record or get that kind of sound. Once we got there, we said, no, we don't want to do that. You know, we want to make a national record. We want you to play the way you play. And we just give our version singing those songs. And that's what we did, and it was really fun because we knew all the songs by heart already and loved them, and just put our kinds of harmonies on your kind of, you know, your meaning Nashville's kind of songs.
You finally got your chance to produce. I think it was a Paul Jones record was the first release, right?
Yes, that's right. That's the first record I ever actually produced. And Paul Jones, I owe a gratitude to, because he's the person who had watched me working on some of the Peter and Gordon records and kind of liked some of my ideas. So he asked me if I would produce some tracks with him. And I did. And the very first track I ever produced is notable now. It was a minor hit. It bubbled into the charts and bubbled out again quite rapidly. But the band I assembled was kind of cool, because on that track I had Jeff Beck playing guitar, Nicky Hopkins, who was a brilliant piano player you probably know about. Nicky Hopkins played piano. And Paul Samuel Smith from the Yardbirds played bass, and Paul McCartney played drums. So it was a good rhythm section.
And Nicky Hopkins finally going into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That's right. Exactly. Yes. That's right. And I've got to write and congratulate Lenny Waronker was included this time. We got the Armored Earth Young Award. And Simon Kirk is a friend of mine who's in Bad Company, so I've got to email him and congratulate him too. That reminds me.
You became the head of A&R at Apple Records, and that was certainly an interesting experiment, having four different people in charge of a company and wanting to be open to artists. But is it safe to say that business acumen was not always a key part of what was going on at Apple?
That's true. It wasn't always a key part. But some people, you know, we're okay on a business front. This guy, Ron Cass, who we hired to run the label, was great. You know, he'd run Liberty Records in America, and he knew his stuff. But inviting everyone to send in their music turned out to be a dud of an idea. We got some really, really unlistenable stuff. With all respect to the great British public, they sent us some pretty weird stuff. I mean, it would consist of things like, you know, 50 pages of lyrics that the person is convinced that John Lennon is going to put music to and send back, things like that, which is a little bit unlikely to happen.
But there was some talent that crossed your path. Some of it came right to your door as James Taylor just showed up unannounced at your home?
Yes. I mean, he'd phoned first, to be fair. I mean, it's more dramatic if I say he showed up unannounced. But he did. Cooch had given him my phone number. And so the call came out of the blue. Danny Korchmar, that is, had given him the phone number. And so when he called, I told him to come over whenever, and then he did show up in person and played me a cassette he had of some tunes he'd cut in the studio, just him and the guitar. And then he picked up my guitar in the flat and played me a couple of tunes in addition. And I was knocked out. I was astonished. I was dumbfounded out by how good he was as a songwriter, how good he was as a guitar player, and as a singer. And so I said, you know, I've got this new job. I can assign people. would you like a record deal? And he said, yes, please, I would. And that was that.
You signed him to Apple
Records? I took him by a couple of days later to the Apple Records office, Savile Row, and introduced him to, I think, George and Paul were there at the time, and introduced him to the proprietors and signed him up.
What did you learn about producing from that first James Taylor album?
I think learning about producing is a continuous process. I'm still learning, and I don't know what I could have specifically assigned to that album. I mean, every project is different, and every situation is different. In James's case, I was addressing, you know, some issues with him and drugs and stuff, and, you know, he'd end up being late for stuff and disappearing and being locked in the bathroom for a while and all kinds of grim stuff that I later knew, realized with that this is a whole world of addiction that was I was seeing in real life, and which eventually, of course, James totally overcame. And so I learned all kinds of different stuff. I learned about life. I learned about drugs. I learned about the genius of great songwriters. And I learned about how, eventually, I think, about how to make a record that got the most out of James's songwriting genius and didn't, and how to make a record that didn't get in the way of his own guitar playing and singing, which has to be the center of attention. At the time, I really wanted to convince people that he wasn't just another long-haired, folky, three-chord, folky player, which he's not, and he wasn't. So I was sort of torn between finding a way of really impressing upon people how special James was and not getting in the way of his songs. And the Apple album, I'm not sure I got it quite right, but then the next album that we did for Warner Brothers in America was Sweet Baby James, and I guess that worked.
Well, and such a great group of players with Cooch, Carole King on keyboards, Lee Sklar, Russ Kunkel. It was the perfect group to showcase.
Oddly enough, Lee Sklar wasn't on Sweet Baby James. I know people commonly think he did. You're right about them being perfect people to surround James. And by the time the record came out, we had found Lee Sklar and he started playing with James live. But oddly enough, on Sweet Baby James, Lee does not play. We haven't found him yet.
Was it your idea to give was it your idea to give musicians credit on the album cover? Because that wasn't really done in those days.
No, that was quite unusual, I think, apparently. I didn't think it was unusual. I didn't really realize, but I learned from the musicians themselves that hadn't usually happened. So if people wanted to hire the people who played on such and such an album, it was quite difficult to find out who that was. But I thought they all deserved credit, and I gave it to them.
You got together with Linda Ronstadt, and you've shared the story before. She had a manager who was, let's say, less than honest in their dealings.
Well, yeah, Herbie Cohen was charming and smart, but he was slightly a crook. So, the band realized something was wrong when they got to their first gig, and he'd made the travel arrangements, and they were met by the FBI at the airport because the tickets were forgeries. And that was back in the days of when there were handwritten flight coupons, you know,
right,
that used to tear out and stuff. And apparently the FBI realized it flagged these air tickets. So they wanted to arrest the whole band, but they protested. And Linda and Kenny Edwards and Bobby Kimmel, the band at the time, were let off in the end because they were innocent completely. And it turned out it was Herbie who pulled some deal to save money and got what turned out to be stolen air tickets. So it was all quite dramatic. But yes, but Herbie was a cool guy, oddly enough, in a way. And Linda bears him no malice, neither do I.
We've spoken with you before about some of the early Linda Ronstadt albums, but I wanted to talk about one of my favorites, 1989's Cry Like a Rainstorm, Howl Like the Wind. So many talented artists that participated, from Aaron Neville to Brian Wilson. I think one of Linda's best vocals of all time comes on that album, and her friend Jimmy Webb's Still Within the Sound of My Voice.
Yes, it's true. Making that album was amazing. I mean, Linda was at the peak of her powers and just sang brilliantly. And Brian Wilson was an interesting one because we decided on Adios and another of the tunes, we wanted some Beach Boys style background vocals. And we kind of looked at each other and went, well, you know, why not aim high, you know? So, and that this was when Brian Wilson was in the care of Dr. Landy.
Right.
I don't know if you remember, who was the evil genius shrink who controlled Brian's life. So working through Dr. Landy, who was in charge of everything, we finally arranged for Brian to come up. And he was happy to sing background vocals, and he sang the most amazing, brilliant background vocals I've ever had in my life. And it was a privilege to be there watching him, because he would just listen to the tune and go, you know, play it again, please. And we played it again. And he'd go, okay, you know, give me seven tracks or whatever it was he wanted. We'd arrange for there to be seven vocal tracks empty that he could fill. And he would just play one part after another, sing one part after another. And they, when they all got added together, they would be a work of genius. And I still, to this day, listen to the background vocals on Adios, and it's just extraordinary. This was before, obviously, of course, auto-tune or anything. So he just sang perfectly in tune and with a perfect and unusual choice of notes.
You have worked on a number of albums with Diana Ross through the years. What's that experience been like?
Amazing. I mean, amazing. Because, you know, you'd hear all these stories about Call Me Miss Ross and, you know, made you, stories that would make you nervous, and did. But I remember when I first worked with her, two things. One, that I was sitting with the engineer, Frank Wolf, and we'd been working on assembling a vocal out of her takes, and we'd been at it for a little while. And we felt, rather than saw, Diana behind us on the sofa stand up. And we went, oh, you know, what's going to happen now? And instead of which, she said, oh, you guys have been at this a long time. Can I get you a coffee or anything? And we went, oh, my God, you know, she's the nicest woman in the world. And she was incredibly charming and fun to work with and so on. And the first time we ever recorded a vocal with her, it was one of those surreal occasions where, you know, she goes out to the microphone for the first time and is going to try the vocal, make sure everything's right in the track. And she starts singing, and I went, oh my God, that's amazing. She sounds just like Diana Ross. well, I should hope so. You know? But so all those Supremes records that, you know, I know by heart, that beautiful, amazing, soulful voice was there in real life. I couldn't believe my luck.
Well, Peter, you're still,
I still
doing,
can't believe my luck.
Still doing.
Can't believe my luck is a good. Yeah, so, I just finished an album with Barbara Streisand now. And
oh, wow.
We delivered that coming out in June.
So. Well, I love the album you did a couple of years ago with Susanna Hoffs, The Deep End.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I love that record. Susanna's an amazing singer and had a great time doing it. I guess, I don't think it was as big a hit as I hoped it would be. But Susanna's amazing. Super smart as well.
Technology has certainly changed so much about the way records, music is made today, but it seems like you've always embraced those changes in technology.
I think so, yes. I mean, it all depends how you use them, you know, but it gives you more flexibility. The things you can do now that you couldn't do then, and those things can be misused as well as fruitfully used. But I find, you know, each time they invent something new, you go, oh, that's pretty cool. Now, is that going to make records better or worse? And you never know is the answer. If things reach a point where they're too perfect, you know, by the time you've timed everything and tuned everything, and it is possible to, by mistake, unintentionally lose some of the soul that's part of the original recording. But it's also possible to make great new recordings that take advantage of the new technology. So I embrace the new technology, I would say, with caution.
Peter Asher's A Musical Memoir of the 60s and Beyond at the Regent Theater, Arlington, Massachusetts, May 18th at 2 o'clock. You can go to regenttheater.com for more information. And another show, June 26th in Alexandria, Virginia. Peter, it is always a delight to talk with you. Thanks so much for making time for us today.
It's my pleasure. I enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate you mentioning the shows and so on. And with any luck, I'll see you there. See you at one of the shows, I hope.